David, you gave an interesting talk last night at the fundraiser for the Center for Justice and Mediation, known locally as CJAM. One of the things that I wanted to ask you is, with so many forces at work to delegitimize even the most highly regarded media sources, with so many sources available at consumers' fingertips to find news that supports their own viewpoint without ever having to consider an alternate point of view, is it idealistic to think that we in the media can assemble an accepted set of facts on which we can base reliable coverage?
I think that's probably the greatest challenge that all of us in the media face right now, is that, you know, the goal, of course, of most journalism is to enlighten fellow citizens, our listeners, our viewers, our readers, and provide them some more context about the world around them, the community around them, and do it in as fairly and as accurately a way as possible. And yet there is a financial incentive, and there are so many media organizations who have found a profit center by trying first to appeal to people's preconceived notions or their opinions. So I'm hopeful. I think that there's still people out there who also want an objective recitation of what has happened in our community today, or what has happened in our nation or our world today. And there's still some outlets that are doing that. It's a small number, but it is, I think, the crucial challenge for journalists, is because it's so much easier in a way to give an opinion or to find people who have an opinion, as opposed to chasing down somebody who's actually at the heart of a story and finding out what happened.
You mentioned last night the tendency for news outlets to take the cheap route and assemble a panelist of, you called it, the pundit class. What does that do to the listener? What does that do to their ability to ferret out real facts?
I think it causes the public to generally mistrust the media. That I think the public knows that there's something that's off when, in the midst of so many important, crucial news stories around the world and around our community, and you have a lot of people who are simply just sitting around and talking about it. Oftentimes, these are people who don't even have a direct impact on the story. They're just observing. It is a lot more expensive at every level to send a reporter with a microphone and a camera into the field to actually where a story is happening and report on, trying to gather, well, what actually was the story. It's much cheaper to bring people into your studio and have five or six people on television just pontificating about it, and you can fill more airtime. And there's also a human nature. We all like to watch, you know, arguments, and as long as we're not involved in them, but seeing two people fight, it's why, you know, wrestling is so popular. We like conflict. But I'm hopeful that people are coming around to the idea that, well, if we really, though, want to address what's happening in our society, we also need to have platforms and environments where people can simply provide the facts.
How can we convince people, those people who don't trust the media, to trust the facts that we're working so hard to dig up?
It's a great question. And I think the only way we can really do it is through time. I think in the short term, some news organizations have had some success by doing strong opinion journalism. But I think most of the public sees through that. And even the news outlets that are considered successful, Fox News and MSNBC being successful with opinion journalism, they're still reaching an incredibly small share of the overall U.S. population. On any given night, maybe 2 or 3 million people are watching Fox News or MSNBC. Well, we live in a country that has 350 million people. So that's, you know, 1% is watching cable news. Well, what are the other 99% doing? And so I think that's where the opportunity is for a lot of journalism outlets, is to try to figure out, okay, let people have their opinion, but let's also have platforms that provide people context and information and facts that can help them make judgments about their lives.
It seems like it's really common nowadays in almost every media outlet to mix fact and opinion. Can you speak to the reporter's job to interpret facts versus editorializing, and how that whole phenomenon impacts the public's ability to trust a news outlet?
So let's take an example of some of the recent hurricanes. And I spoke about this a little bit in front of CJAM, that there's an inherent conflict even when a hurricane comes in and wipes out, you know, Southeast Texas, and you've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who have lost their homes. But the conflict is that, well, when you dig deeper into sort of the history of Houston, you see that there have been no zoning laws, that people have been building on floodplains, that the National Flood Insurance Program hasn't stopped people from building in areas that they shouldn't. So maybe if there had been some zoning laws and been some restrictions and some control, fewer people would have been flooded out. Now, at the time that people are having to leave their houses in canoes, that's maybe not the time to report the story, but there is an element of that story, perhaps a few days later, that it's worth the media chasing down. And in most cases, journalists don't have enough time to gather every single fact available. So they, at a certain point, have to make a judgment call.
I want to shift a minute to ask you about tactics you might have developed as a reporter and an interviewer. I was listening last week very briefly to a syndicated national program, 1A, with Joshua Johnson. The topic was freedom of speech, and he had as one of his guests a student who was part of the Black Lives Matter chapter at the College of William and Mary. Earlier in the month, that chapter had basically shut down a speaker from the ACLU who was speaking on their campus about freedom of speech. And he had a number of guests. She was one of them. But early in the show, he gave her the opportunity to voice her opinion. And she was so emotionally invested in that position, she couldn't hear an opposing view, no matter how diplomatically it was stated. And she was ready to hang up on the show early on. And I wasn't able to listen to the full show, but I'm wondering, how do you keep someone like that engaged in a dialogue? If we're striving for civil dialogue and trying to find solutions that we can all buy into to major problems, how do you keep them engaged?
One of the ways is to try to not only appreciate and acknowledge their emotional investment. We want people to be emotionally invested in the society around them. But after acknowledging and showing some respect for those passions, then I think part of the challenge and part of the obligation as an interviewer is to try to get them to put themselves in the shoes or in the mindset of somebody else, or be able to appreciate even perhaps a basic sentiment that the other side may have. And they start to acknowledge a little bit, yeah, there is validity to the opposite point of view. I think once you can start chipping away at that, then you also begin to signal to your audience that there is legitimacy perhaps to both sides. And you start to be able to test out opinions on both sides or arguments on both sides.
You mentioned last night that tapping into news reports from a variety of sources helps you be a better anchor, a better reporter, and perhaps a better citizen. Can you be more specific about why that's important?
By listening to BBC or reading the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or conservative websites or progressive websites, I think you start to be able to hear a wider variety of stories, not just sort of how stories are analyzed, but you get exposed to more information. And the more information I think people are exposed to, you start to be able to then see, okay, well, where is the crossover? Where is their sort of general agreement? Because then it also helps all of us evaluate, well, what can I really believe? What is the information that's most relevant to me? And it also begins to help you evaluate the credibility of the news organizations that you put the most trust in.
Can you give us some examples of news sources that you tap into on a daily basis?
Yeah, so one of our big competitors at I-24 News is BBC. They are owned by the British government, so there's a certain kind of agenda that I think they have. But the BBC website, for example, is, I think, you know, it's one of the websites that I check in first thing in the morning, because they do a terrific job of covering events around the globe. It helps me sort of think about, well, what are the stories that we may be covering later that night on our global news channel? The Washington Post and the New York Times, to me, provide the most accurate recitation of politics and economy and events that are happening in the United States and also to a certain extent around the world. Beyond that, I also will go to Daily Caller, which is a conservative website. They do a pretty hard-hitting job in thinking critically about progressives. Likewise, there's a website called Think Progress, which does a very credible job in thinking critically about the Republican-led Congress. And so it's a constant going to various websites that may be very skeptical of establishment decisions or political leaders, and they're all providing different snippets of the entire sort of fabric of what we're covering. And that whole sort of group of information, then I feel better armed, not only as an anchor and a journalist, but also as a citizen to be able to understand what's happening.
There are journalists who join the profession because they thought that their in-depth investigative reporting efforts would affect change in the world, and they're not seeing that. What would you say to them? Do you have any words of encouragement?
Well, I'd say the most important thing is all we can do. We can't, as journalists, tell a society or a community or a nation how to respond. All we can do is put information out there, and then at the end of the day or the end of the year or at the end of the election or whatever it is, you know, the great thing about this country is that, you know, the country then gets to decide whether it wants to make a decision based on any factor that any voter wants. It's still worthwhile, though, because for all of the times when an investigative piece doesn't have an impact, there's still a huge number of instances where investigative reporting does have an impact, and it causes a policy change or a personnel change, or it causes an issue to suddenly rise to the forefront. For example, had it not been for investigative reporters, we wouldn't have known about the Harvey Weinstein scandal and sexual harassment. Well, because of that, I mean, Harvey Weinstein may never go to jail. He's been disgraced. His career is over. But all of a sudden in our society, because of those investigative journalists who started that trail, we now have an incredible discussion underway about sexual harassment and what does it mean to be sexually harassed in the workplace or in the office environment or in hotels. And we have an entire community of people now, the Me Too movement, where people online are feeling emboldened and empowered to talk about instances where they've been sexually harassed. So we've essentially, because of investigative reporters, been able to change the dialogue about what we're talking about this country and got a lot of people to talk about an issue that I think was long overdue. So it may not feel initially like your investigative story is changing anybody's opinions or is having the desired outcome, but it's a ripple effect, right? It's like throwing a pebble in the water, and there is a sort of ripple that goes across the stream or the lake, and you may not be able to see the impact that it has, but when enough of those ripples sort of form, it starts to form a wave that can take a life of its own.
You know, it's interesting. I noticed in the Washington Post this morning, there was an article saying that the folks who came forward about Bill O'Reilly's indiscretions sort of felt, I don't know what the correct word is. I can't remember the word the Post used, but, they were, I guess, disappointed that their efforts didn't rise to the same level of outrage that the Weinstein story did. Mm. Why do you think the O'Reilly story didn't rise the hackles as much as the Weinstein story?
I think in part because Bill O'Reilly, at least when it first came out, he had the most powerful cable news organization, one of the most powerful cable channels in the world defending him. He had all of Fox News at his back, supporting him, helping him reach the initial settlements, trying to browbeat any reporter that would dig into this, forcing all the people to sign non-disclosure agreements so people couldn't come out and talk about it. And even when people did start talking about it, it was only once, 100 advertisers started to say, we're not going to advertise on the show or on Fox News, that's when Fox News ultimately decided, all right, to cut the cord with him. Weinstein's a little bit different because I think Weinstein didn't have the Miramax film company is not as powerful, ironically. It doesn't have the same sort of platform as a Fox News channel does. But the outcome is still eventually the same, right? I mean, Bill O'Reilly lost his career, lost his perch. Harvey Weinstein has lost his career, lost his ability to influence Hollywood. And so sometimes because of factors that have nothing to do with journalism, but everything to do with the person who is the target of an investigation story and what sort of resources they may have to either defend themselves or hit back, sometimes that can also shape the outcome of where a story goes.
Can we go back to your discussion about why you value the BBC and its global coverage? There are a lot of people in America today who really aren't interested in what's going on in the rest of the world. They're about America first, and there are those who really think that America is the best at everything. Mm. Why is it valuable to pay attention to global news?
And we ask ourselves that every day in our own story meetings when we talk about, okay, we're going to be talking about the Kurds in Iraq who are seeking independence, and why is it important for Americans to hear about this story? Well, with us, we look at international news stories and we have a saying, particularly with our Middle East coverage, that what happens in the Middle East tends not to stay in the Middle East. There's so many events that happen around the world that inevitably are going to have an impact here in the United States, whether it's terrorism, whether it's the economy with oil prices, whether it's trade wars, whether it's the ability of people to travel freely back and forth to the United States, whether it's the experience that we may have in terms of our own security going through airports or crossing our borders. So the constant challenge, I think, for us is to report on, okay, for example, with the Kurds, this is a group that was instrumental in the United States' efforts to defeat Islamic State in Syria and in Iraq. They are now seeking independence from Iraq. The United States, which was supporting them and training them and providing them with weapons against Islamic State, suddenly the United States has no position on their bid for independence. Well, that's sort of an interesting point for where our government to be, but the reason we think it's important for people to hear about this is because it's not just as simple as the Kurds are seeking independence. It's this is a group that could suddenly decide, okay, they're going to not fight the war against Islamic State anymore. They're not going to be on the front lines anymore. Likewise, if we're talking about the civil war in Syria, why should Americans care about Syria? It's a world away. It's not our problem. So what? Well, it's causing a huge refugee crisis in Europe, which is then sparking a certain right-wing nationalism in Europe and an anti-immigration stance. And there is an argument that as people in Europe, particularly Muslims, feel disenfranchised or displaced or aren't being able to sort of be integrated in society, that's causing a certain breeding ground for the kind of terrorism that Islamic State wants to perpetuate around the world. And so we've seen a number of terrorist attacks in Europe. All of these issues, I think, are relevant to the United States because we're a society, unfortunately, that has been hit badly by terrorism. We care about our security. The U.S. economy is so intertwined with events around the rest of the world. And Americans generally are more mobile and engaged with the rest of the world, whether it's online or through travel. So events that happen on the other side of the planet tend to have a much greater impact here on the United States than they might have 15, 20 years ago. The challenge with all of us who cover international events, though, is to draw the connection and to say, okay, it's relevant what's happening in Africa or in Asia or in Indonesia where there's a war on, you know, drug smugglers. It's relevant to the United States for the following reasons. And I think Americans, if you can give them a reason to feel connected to these stories, they will then pay attention to the stories themselves. The BBC doesn't always do such a great job of connecting international news to, you know, either Great Britain or the United States because that's not their goal. They're just sort of cover the world for the sake of covering the world. Our goal on I-24 News is both to cover the world, but also to make it relevant and to show the connections between the rest of the world and the United States and why those connections can impact the daily lives of Americans.
I do have questions that I've formulated just with our interns in mind, because we do have a number of media school students who do internships with us. When you were conducting an interview and you know that the person or people that you're interviewing are misrepresenting something, how do you decide when to push back and when to not?
It's interesting because you can, if you have a certain limited amount of time with an interviewer, I mean, to me, the goal of an interview is you want to take whatever the existing news story is and you want to move it forward. It's, you know, either somebody who's reacting to a news event who their reaction would be sort of interesting and enlightening and perhaps foreshadow where the story is going, or you want to try to peel back some of the thinking behind whether it's a political debate or an analysis of a news story. When somebody is misrepresenting or telling something that is perhaps just sort of half the story, it depends how significant it is. I mean, in the law, for example, in order to be convicted of a crime, you have to have intentionally violated the law. Just sort of accidentally violating the law is usually a defense. That tends to apply pretty well to journalism as well. If somebody sort of accidentally states that, what would be a good example? That, you know, Puerto Rico was, you know, completely, you know, Puerto Rico was hit by a hurricane and you know, their electronic grid was terrible to begin with. Okay, that's, you know, technically that's accurate. However, there are reasons why their electric grid was problematic that really had nothing to do with the hurricane. It may have had something to do with U.S. laws that were imposed on Puerto Rico that hurt their economy, that caused a lot of things in Puerto Rico to be sort of second rate. It just sort of depends, and this is sort of a sense of sort of feel and experience. You have to try to think in your interview, where do I want to take this interview? And by calling out this person and saying, okay, no, wait a second, you know, Puerto Rico's electronic grid was actually problematic, not just because of their own fault, but because of the fault of laws that were imposed on them, that can take you sort of down a rabbit hole into sort of a side discussion or a side argument. And the question is that relevant to where you ultimately want to go? But if somebody comes on and says, well, you know, the Affordable Care Act, and, you know, healthcare premiums are, you know, skyrocketing and, you know, it's the worst program ever. At that point, I think there was an obligation at that to say, well, wait a second, there are 25 million people who have health insurance who didn't have it before. It's sometimes a matter of providing some context. And then it may be up to the person you're interviewing to decide, well, do they want to sort of fight and engage on the point that you're making? But I think it's never a bad thing to try to stop somebody in the middle of an interview, try to provide a little bit of context, while at the same time trying to get to your point about where do you want the interview to go.
Could you say what your top attributes or skills are that enable you to be successful in the profession?
I'd say the most important thing is to be able to think critically, to be able to read as much as you possibly can, and be able to understand and digest what you're reading. The other thing that's, I think, particularly in journalism, which is sort of a forgotten art, is the ability to write. People who, A, you have to know either, you know, how to type, obviously, but to be able to write well, to think in sort of short, punchy, matter-of-fact sort of sentences, and be able to then not only sort of write what, you know, story is, but also to be able to talk off of the top of your head. So, for example, somebody may be a great writer, but they have to be able to, if you put the keyboard away and you put your notes away and you ask a journalist, tell me about this particular story, can that journalist off the top of their head give you the three or four most salient points or facts or context to the story just talking about it? If they can, then they know the story in their head and they're going to be successful in covering that story, whether they're writing about it or talking about it or discussing it. I think sometimes we have, I think, a focus in journalism school on, you know, the equipment or, you know, how to sort of, you know, write about a story or how to sort of interview without also understanding, well, it's important to be able to think critically about things and to have a curiosity. So this is sort of a long-winded answer saying, you want to be curious, you want to have an insatiable appetite for information, reading more information than you need to know. You want to be able to sort of write well, but you also want to be able to be so comfortable with the material, whatever material you're talking about, that you can talk about it coherently off the top of your head. If you can do all that, the world is your oyster in the world of journalism.
The challenge, of course, is that everybody's always on a tight deadline. So doing the kind of in-depth research, at least for our folks who show up and have to complete a story in a four-hour shift, do their research, get their interviews in, write it up, sometimes it's really difficult for them to attain that really, you know, a deep level of understanding. Have you developed any tactics for working quickly?
I'd say is to know who you can call or what you can read that will provide you with incredible information. Sometimes if you've, you know, got a very tight window, and it happens a lot, it happened a lot in my career early on when I was just starting off reporting and I was working in Little Rock, Arkansas, and I was covering the early stages of the Whitewater investigation, which was led by Ken Starr, an independent counsel, and a team of special prosecutors who were looking at the Clinton business dealings and their partners. And I had spent a little bit of time in my career in federal, you know, court covering things, but not a lot. Well, I developed a couple of attorneys, both on the staff, but also outside the staff, who were able to sort of help me understand what's the process by which a federal criminal investigation goes. How does a grand jury operate? What are the salient things to know? And these were people that I could go to in a crunch to say, here's something I don't understand. Not so much about the story, but I'm trying to anticipate where the story is going to go. Tell me a little bit about that. I think if you as a journalist have a couple of people, even if it's in a brand new story, and you can find even one person who knows a lot about the story or who knows a lot about the context or the process and can teach you a little bit about, you know, the process of where this particular story is going, or if it's an economic story, why is it that organic food is better for you than, you know, genetically modified food. If you have somebody who can explain that in just a couple of minutes, you then become an expert and it helps you be able to put the story in some context. You may not use 98% of what that person tells you, but by having it on your mind, it helps you understand, well, where can I take this story? And inevitably, there's going to come a moment where something that somebody told you might be useful to you.
I think journalists early in their training don't always consider the fact that they can call and talk to sources and not necessarily be interviewing them for a story. Like what you said about you may not use 98% of what you got, but you're getting a better understanding.
Yeah, I mean, to this day, I mean, even when we do interviews on I-24 News, we may have somebody on for 4 or 5 minutes. But we may have them for a few minutes afterwards or a few minutes beforehand where we'll ask them questions that aren't relevant to the topic of the day. But we may say, look, you know, while we have you talking about, you know, the latest in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, what do you make of what's going on in Saudi Arabia and sometimes the secret discussions or negotiations that they're having? And the person will provide us with sort of information about, oh, I was just in Saudi Arabia. I was talking with such and such who's related to the prince, and this is where they're going. And it, again, it's information that may have nothing to do with the topic at hand, but it helps us so that the next time we are doing a story about Saudi Arabia, that we suddenly have that background. And so I think the key is, particularly for, you know, journalism students and young journalists, is you want to be as curious as possible. People will tell you if they're tired of you asking questions or they don't have time, they'll tell you, hey, I don't have time for this. But the more information that you can ask people, the more questions you can ask on a wider variety of subjects, that information eventually will come back and help you at a certain point.
I asked you about journalists who joined the profession because they wanted to make a difference and now may feel discouraged that their efforts are not promoting change and want to get out. What about in the beginning, if you're really trying to decide if this profession is for you, if you're going, I don't know where to go from here, there are plenty of people who will tell you newspapers are dead, you know, journalism is a lost cause, you won't make any money, you won't be able to find a job. How can a young person figure out, a college student, I'm thinking about our interns again.
Yeah.
You know, how do you push through that negativity and really decide if you have a future and if there really are or aren't jobs?
I would say, and this would be goes beyond just journalism, that it's particularly important, I think, for college students and people just out of college, that you want to make sure that whatever job you're into, you wake up and you're excited to do that job that day. And that if you are passionate about something, if you're enthusiastic about what you're doing, the money will eventually be there. It may not, you know, turn you into a, you know, a Steve Jobs or a billionaire, but, you know, he wasn't thinking about money when he was, you know, working on the early days of Apple. He just had some ideas for some computer stuff and was working out of his garage. The key is to be able to be so enthusiastic and passionate about what you're doing that you give everything possible to that career or that profession or that job. Because if you do that, eventually you will find a platform or an organization that will value that and will pay you a living wage, certainly, to be able to do that. It is true that journalism doesn't pay very much. It is true that journalism is changing, but all of society is changing rapidly. I said to the folks at CJAM that within 20 years, you know, one out of every two jobs in the United States is going to disappear because of technology and automation. So people who right now are working in factories or the carrier plant in Indianapolis, they're seeing their jobs disappear. What are they going to do? Well, they're going to have to go through some retraining. There's incredible economic uncertainty for virtually everybody. Everybody's facing an incredible transformation of our society. So the most important thing and the opportunity, I'd say, is if you love journalism and you wake up every day and you're excited to chase a story or to tell a story or to write a story or to shoot a story or to talk to people, as long as you're passionate about something. And it could be the same thing if you're passionate about opening a restaurant or you're passionate about artwork or you're passionate about, you know, German literary history. Whatever it is, as long as you're enthusiastic and passionate about it, eventually the money will be there.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Sarah, it was nice chatting with you. Thank you.
I'm Sarah Vaughn with WFHB. I've been talking with David Schuster of I-24 News.